once we put things together and express it to somebody, something happens. We become more alive because we are expressing what we're expressing in terms of what's real. And what's real is not static. What's real is continually moving. And what's real is the experience of everything moving and everything changing from minute to minute.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, IPAoffthecouch.org. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Mel Bornstein. Dr. Bornstein is a training and supervising psychoanalyst at the Michigan Psychoanalytic Institute, and he is the editor of the journal Psychoanalytic Inquiry. Mel is also one of the elders of our field, and you will hear him today describe in great and passionate detail his experiences over the past many decades of practice. He'll also describe what this current period of uncertainty is like for him, and what he makes clear, the leitmotif of his work and his life, is what he calls the love of life. And he describes how the love of life exists in him. It has helped him deal with childhood difficulties that he describes. It helps him reach patients and engage with them and heal them. I hope you enjoy hearing it as I did. I had a smile on my face in much of my listening. You may find the same experience. Here's my conversation with Dr. Mel Bornstein. Mel, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you here. Mel, you and I have known each other for some time, and I thought at this time of uncertainty and fear that your voice would be an important voice to bring forward. Because, Mel, your voice is the voice of one of our elders in the field. You are an elder by virtue of being 87 years old. You are an elder by virtue of practicing psychoanalysis for 64 years. And you're an elder because I know this about you, because you think deeply and care passionately about the matters at hand. And as long as we have you here, Mel, I thought this would be a good opportunity to invite you to look back over those many decades you've been practicing, to share with us what it looks like from your vantage point, what the field looks like at the beginning, in the middle, now, over your decades, how it's changed, how your clinical work has evolved, how you have been changed by the evolving of your clinical work. there's much to discuss, including clinical vignettes that demonstrate your thinking over these periods of time. But that's for a bit. Right now, let's start by your sharing with us what this period of time has been like for you.
Harvey, thank you for such lovely words about me, which in itself is an inspiration. So I will start. In terms of where I am today, in the present moment with all that goes on around us, where am I about this in terms of being a psychoanalyst and being working at this for this length of time? So let me set the stage so you know where I'm coming from. For the past 67 years, I have been immersed in psychoanalytic ideas that I have been able to use to help me in my development, in my ability to be in touch with myself, to reach out to others, to express my love and interest in others, and to grow. This could not have happened if it were not for the ideas, the concepts, and I imagine the people who developed them having to do with psychoanalysis. So let me start. You see, when Harvey, you said that I'll probably begin by asking you about how you see things right now with the stresses and the strains that we are all involved in. When I thought about this, about an hour and a half after I thought about it, Alberto Camus' book on the epidemic came to mind. And after all these years free associating each morning in an effort to gain emotional strength and put things together, I know that when the thought of Camus and his book came to mind, I knew that this was connected to deep, important issues that are inside of me that automatically, unconsciously got organized and pushed its way up. And I got the thought of Camus' Plague, the name of the book. And when I thought about that, and I read a little bit about Camus, things became quite illuminating. Camus wrote this book a couple of years after the end of the Second World War, after enduring pain and suffering and dislocation, I believe in Algeria. And within a year, he began writing this book. He began using his experiences and put them together in novel form to be able to not only use his experience, but to communicate it to the world. That feat that I just described of Camus is my idea of what psychoanalysis is all about, and the curative, developmental power of psychoanalysis. He was able to go inside of himself, Camus, and go through what he actually suffered and developed a story. The story was that there was a plague in this small town, and people were dying, just like they're dying in the United States and in the world. They were dying, and no one knew what to do about it. And it looked like there'll be no end to it until several people of the village got together and they talked to one another. They talked just like we do in analysis. And in their talking, they were sharing their pain, their suffering, their fear with one another. And each of them began to respond to the other. And out of that, a transformation occurred. Some creative idea developed. And that is, I bet it's the rats. I bet that this is where it comes from. I don't know how they got it in the book, but they came out of it with that idea. And they went and they killed the rats, and the plague was over. Now, metaphorically, this is not too far from psychoanalysis. People come in, they're suffering, they don't know what to do with this. They begin talking, they associate, they talk more, and in the talking, there's a deep connection between the patient and the analyst. It's not cognitive. It touches to the core of the analyst as it touches to the core of the patient. And in communicating that and experiencing there is another human being there who somehow gets how deep my experience is, with that, there is a discharge of feeling. There is an effort at creativity and transformation, and there's a greater wholeness in both patient and analysts. That's what Camus wrote about. He got it. I don't know if he was familiar with analysis. He certainly was familiar with existentialism. He was familiar with the pessimism of existentialism. Things are the way they are, and we can't do anything about it, like the Second World War. The unique thing about psychoanalysis that I experienced is that process permits you to do something about things that you had no idea that you can do anything about, through the talking and through the concepts of psychoanalysis. Ladies and gentlemen, this is what I've been doing for 60-some years. I get up every morning, pretty much. I get on a bike, a stationary bike, and I free associate virtually every day, all this time. And in the free association, what I learned is there's all kinds of stuff, of course. But the work of putting into words and getting things together with the idea of communicating, that strengthens me. It's a strengthening process, and this is why I know it. I can free associate and I can feel good. It's a good day. And I did this and that and the other thing yesterday, and I really feel good, and it reminds me of other good things. But invariably, when I'm on that track, within a short time, I've regressed into fantasies and uncomfortable things and things that indicate that I've withdrawn from reality and what I'm going to do today and how I'm going to do it and all of that. I withdraw into myself. And once I'm into myself, I give myself a hard time. I try to undo what happened in the past and I try to get even. But if I free associate further, There's a movement. There's a transformation from being stuck on old garbage stuff, things that make me unfeeling. As I free associate and put it together and communicate it, things open up again. And that's because my view is on reality. It's not on fantasy. It's on the things that have happened. And once my view is on reality, then I can be creative. Then I can put things together in a surprising way. So I went through all of this because I'm telling you about myself, and I'm telling you about the epidemic.
And how you're sustaining yourself in the epidemic, and how you're using it to be creative.
And that's what analysis can offer as far as what I'm seeing. I mean, what we've been hearing the last couple of weeks, what can we do? Well, of course we can go out in the community, but that's not the power of analysis. The power of analysis is communicating with one another, sharing with another, coming up with ideas like killing the rats, and that's what we can offer in some form, because that's uniquely psychoanalysis. So that's where I am in terms of the how I experience my present day life as a analyst, trying to make sense out of what's going on around us.
And my sense is that this was long in coming. This was 64 years ago when you first started. You weren't doing this, and you weren't even imagining it.
You can say that again. I wasn't doing it.
So can you walk us through a bit of your path?
Sure. So I'll tell you about an early clinical situation, which before I do that, I got to tell you about my path to orient you where I'm coming from. My path is made up of the same kind of things that every human being is. There are memories, there are fantasies, there are feelings, and there is an ability that I think makes us human to bring it together, to put language onto it, and communicate it. I mean, in theory, that's the ego, or that's what Freud had in mind when he talked about the ego, unlike the other stuff that is drive-ridden or feeling-ridden. So in addition to that, there's another piece, that the parts that are difficult to put together and to communicate, those parts can be repressed and walled off. And it makes it us difficult to get to it as we try to put things together and express these things. One of the important things is that once we put things together and express it to somebody, something happens. We become more alive because we are expressing what we're expressing in terms of what's real. And what's real is not static. What's real is continually moving. And what's real is the experience of everything moving and everything changing from minute to minute. It's movement. It's like being on a roller coaster. It's a four-dimensional experience. That's what happens when we bring things together and find a way to express it, communicate it to another person who is not us, that lives out there in the context of time is always changing. So we are talking about the end game in bringing it all together and sharing as a quality of feeling alive. And feeling alive is being in motion. And it means being vulnerable. and you can't stop time, and you have to do something with it. And what you can do is be creative and share it. So when you say, let's tell me about yourself, I'm giving you an outline of what's inside of me. And the detail of that outline is a number of significant things occur to me that has molded who I am. When I was 7 years old, my mother took mentally ill. She was hospitalized, and she was institutionalized for much of my early life anyways. Obviously, I'm talking about an enormous trauma that had to do with helplessness and humiliation and certainly rage and certainly sadness and loss. That happened to me as a seven-year-old. And as a result of that experience, I try to put it all together, and I try to work with it. This has happened to me. But parts of it I couldn't do. I set it aside. And what happened to me during my mid-childhood is I became phobic about my mother. I was scared to even be in her presence. Now, we know that what this represents are my feelings and my experiences that I couldn't grapple with and I couldn't be creative with, but it was there. So with that as a background, whatever I have done from that point on has somehow been colored by this basic experience. Because whatever I have done, I've tried to bring together and get to my narrative and reach out and feel alive and feel true. That's what I've tried to do. But what I had to stumble with is those early traumas. And when I got into analysis years later, I began developing the strength of dealing with this. So anyways, with this particular background, one of my first cases that is still imprinted in my head was of a young man who had just flunked out of medical school, who was depressed, who was rather insulated, kind of distant. He came for help. And he began telling me the story. Look inside of you, free associate, tell me what's going on. And basically what he told me about was an enormously seductive mother who smothered him and a father who was kind of indifferent. And that was the story. Now, where I was at the time is there was a big deal about aggression. It was before Kernberg and his borderline personality disorder, but aggression was really the problem. And I certainly saw aggression. And within a short period of time, something happened. He started acting crazy to me. He started swearing at me. He started putting me down. He started demeaning me. And I didn't know what to do with that. Telling him he was angry is not going to help. And we didn't know in those days anything about Melanie Klein, projective identification. I hadn't read anything about it. I remember I was the first one in the Institute who began reading about this. But it was not in how we learned. We learned about instinct and drives and fantasies and repression and transference. But this kind of thing we didn't learn. We didn't know. The other thing was this experience in which he was so nasty to me affected me deeply, because I walked away from those sessions with him inside of me, and I was fighting with him, and I was getting even with him, and I was sounding just the way he sounded to me. I was sounding to me the way he was sounding to me. And in all of that, I realize that I've withdrawn. I'm not really with him. That I felt. I wasn't feeling anything. I was in a state of withdrawal into something in me that basically represented a peculiar kind of fantasy, a kind of narcissistic fantasy which gives me some kind of stability and gives him that thing. And there, the fantasy is that the boundaries were not distinct. So I can feel like him. I can be like him. He can be like me. And we were going back and forth in that way. Now, that's what I felt. I had nobody to ask about this. I used projective identification, that you were angry and your anger comes into me and my anger comes into you. I knew I was close in some way, but it really wasn't very helpful. What began helping me is how deeply affected I was by him. That somehow, because of what he was expressing, it touched on something in me that got me to what I was experiencing with him. And Harvey, this really was my first control case. I didn't dare tell my supervisors what was going on, because I thought they would drive me out of town if I told them what was going on. I didn't understand it. So in a way, I only had myself to really rely on in that way. And what I relied on was that I picked something up from him. I withdrew from reality in some way. I got immersed in this fantasy, and then I began reading that the fantasy itself has structure. It gives one a sense of stability in the guise of trauma. And then it began occurring to me. And what occurred to me was how I, in my association, went from all of this to my mother, and how overwhelmed by it I was. And that took me into what she was experiencing, that she was acting so unmanageable at the time. It took me from one to the other. And then in a bit, I was able to put more together. I read more, and I got the idea that all this stuff is a defense against owning one's trauma, being able to live well with trauma. Not that you're simply was seduced, but you got to take it and you have to grow with it. So that is early. That's early Mel in all of this.
Mel, you have encapsulated in this story. I'm smiling as I'm listening to you and I'm responding. Such a rich and multi-layered presentation involving you, involving the history of the field, involving the psychology as you understood it of your first control case, of what it felt like to be a candidate, of the history of the times. I mean, one could listen to our first 20 minutes together over and over again as in a text and unpack the history of psychoanalysis in the United States. And you've just said, and that was the beginning. So we have some more time. Catch us up. Where have you gone from there?
My immersion in this work. And there is, for many years, with supervision and being told that this is a defense against aggression, and this is Oedipal, this is your countertransference in relationship to it, and you're acting out with your patient, and you're not acting out with your patient, and the patient doesn't have the right structure for analysis. I mean, those things I heard. Or you're doing just very well. But something was missing, because I had a piece of me that was uptight. It was like there's stuff inside me that I couldn't get out. Something was, and as I worked more, I realized that I couldn't get it out because I was afraid to get it out, or I didn't know how to get it out. And what it had to do with is what I came to see. And incidentally, I came to see it after years of working with Harvey and writing about an analytic process. Well, writing about the process means, first of all, you got to write about what's there. You got to write about how you organized it. You got to write about how you expressed it and the difficulty that you and the patient has. And finally, the closeness that both of you had. That's what you have to write about. And people have enormous difficulty in doing it because they have to walk through it. And there are pieces in all of this that are difficult, if not impossible, to walk through. So what I began seeing recently, it isn't the driving element in this is really not the aggression. It's not even the hurt. It's not the excitement. The driving element is the love of life. And why do I say that? Because this is what this is what Descartes said, I think and therefore I am. He, back in 1600, was looking for something he could be sure of, and then he could build a scientific structure on it. And what he's saying I'm sure of is I am because I think. Now, where I went in all of this, it really came to, if I look at myself and I look at my 67 years about psychoanalysis, there is plenty love for psychoanalysis that drives me. There's plenty of feeling that through this I can grow. And I love life, and that's what's motivating me, a love of life. And what I'm saying is, in all patients and therapists, the basic element that keeps them together and keeps them coming and keeps them working is a love of life. And this is what we really offer them. We don't offer them sex. We don't offer them aggression. We don't offer them simple reason. We offer them a recognition of a love of living. And because of the love of living, then one can immerse oneself in organizing oneself and communicating and growing. Because there is this basic thing, entity, that we all have. And it took me a long time to get there. But to me, that makes the most sense. It's that. And because of a love of life, then what one does is one gets in and tries to communicate and deal with one's traumas and one's difficulty. And what happens is one gets into even more difficulty because you love life so much. You know, you want to do something with it and you become overwhelmed. And what happens then is you bury this love of life and you push it away from reality and it goes inside of you and it turns into aggression that is overpowering, or being overwhelmed that's overpowering, or things that are really overpowering. And the problem in analysis is it's the power of the id. And I'm saying is it doesn't start that way. It's the power of living life. And when you live life, you get into difficulty. And when you get into difficulty, then you have to work it out, or you say, heck with all of this. I'm going away from this life stuff. It's the aggression, but the aggression and all this other stuff gets their power from life.
Let me ask you a question about this. You describe the patients, and they come looking for a love of life, and we offer them, you're saying, a love of life. What leads you to turn that phrase as you do, as opposed to they're looking for love towards and from their analyst? I'm thinking of that first control case you described, who filled the room with aggression, and he felt it, and you felt it, and you both withdrew and dissociated from it. But you also, in addition to describing his mother, described a missing father. And it is so hard for male analysts with male analysts to own their love. And I have seen it many times where they will defend it with bluster and aggression and sort of childish machismo. But what they are looking for is struggling with the importance of their love for their analyst and their wish for love from it.
Yeah.
That's a little
yeah.
different than a love of life. That's a love of a person. And I'm interested about what leads you to say it that way in contrast to how I just said it.
Well, I say it that way because it seems that the love of the analysts, that's very nice, but that's really tertiary in terms of their interests. And it can be transference, which is really an idealization and all of that. That what makes our patient tick is the desire to live and live well. And to live well, they have to put things together. They have to be open. They have to express these things. That's my impression of what analysis. That's why I am in analysis for all these years. It's not simply a love for a father. It's a love of living. That's why I've lived 87. I'll probably live a little longer. That's what moves me, and I think that moves everybody here and the patients. And with recognizing that clinically, that's important because right from the beginning, we're on the same wavelength. Any patient and me. We're on the same wavelength. We're basically motivated by a love of life. They're coming in, they want a better life. And then I begin telling them, you know, helping them put things together. And they get into the old dangers. It's not safe to love life. You're going to be overwhelmed. You're going to be rejected. You're going to be vulnerable. And the way analysis works to me is I stay there and say to them, look, I love what I'm doing and I love life and you love life. So let me tell you, what you just told me about is how you were molested or seduced or traumatized and all of that. And you feel that it's impossible for you to talk about it and own it. And I'm showing you it's not impossible because I love life and I know what that feels like in some way. And I'm showing you I can own it and make something good out of it. Now, that's Mel's understanding of therapeutic action in terms of the love of life and why it goes, why it works. Because there's a love of life and I don't think it's safe to love life. And I see in you, in your love of life, that it is safe. And with that experience, I'm able to integrate this terror and this impossibility that I felt, and that's in the transference, but in the reality of the moment, I see it's all possible. So you're asking me why or how. This is how I got there anyway.
I hear you. Mel, I introduced you at the beginning by referring to you as one of the elders, and
are you apologizing?
No, I'm not at all. I'm doubling down, as a matter of fact. You really have given me and us a tutorial about your vision of this work, how valuable it is, how full of life it is, to state an understatement, how deeply immersed you are, not only to, obviously to your own benefit and to the benefit of the people who you touch in your life, but certainly your patients over the many, many decades who have gotten their own version of a taste of your love of life. That is your gift to them, and it's quite special. And it's also your gift to me and our group that has been working together for many years, and to the listeners of this podcast who I think will be smiling as I have been in listening to you share your life and your love of life. I want to thank you.
And thank you so much. You really touched my love.
Likewise.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.